Hi, Brian.
Hi, Katie. And hello, dear listeners. Well, we're officially in the dog days of summer. I don't know where that expression came from, dog days of summer.
Ruff! We are. I don't know how it quite happened, but we're already into August. I can't believe it. You know what the summer always reminds me of, Brian?
I think I have a guess.
Summer loving had me a blast. Summer loving happened so fast. Met a girl, cute as can be. Met a boy, crazy for me.
Did you have a
lot
of...
sounded like Fofo Gigio.
That's an excellent reference. Did you have a lot of summer romances, Katie?
No, not really. Actually,
no, not really.
Maybe a few, but that song goes out to my hubby, John Molnar. Hi, Molnar. He might not like the line that it happened so fast, but that's another story.
Anywho, we're not putting out new episodes for the rest of August, but as we mentioned in last week's show, we didn't want to leave you guys completely hanging. So we're revisiting some of our favorite conversations from the podcast, and we also have a surprise podcast up our sleeve that we really think you're going to like.
Very exciting. To kick off our greatest hit series, we're going to return to our interview with actress and activist and one of my favorite people, one of the smartest people I've ever met, actually, Laverne Cox.
Like a lot of people, I was first introduced to Laverne in her role as Sophia in the Netflix show Orange is the New Black.
Which, by the way, released its sixth season just a few weeks ago.
Now, if you're familiar with Laverne, you may also know that she is transgender.
In fact, she's the first openly trans person ever nominated for an Emmy for her role as Sophia.
That's right. And Laverne is also a prominent spokeswoman and advocate for LGBT rights. And Katie, she helped inspire you to make your documentary Gender Revolution, if I remember correctly.
That's right. She did. And she was so loving in the process when a lot of people were very critical. And I'll always be grateful for that. We're going to get into that during the course of our conversation.
And if you're unfamiliar with transgender issues, or you're still learning what it means to be transgender, or you want to refresh yourself.
Or gender nonconforming, non-binary, there are all sorts of new vernacular about this.
Yeah, and I was new to most of these issues. So Gender Revolution really is a remarkable documentary. I'm not just saying this is your friend, and
thank
I encourage
you.
All of our listeners to go watch it if you haven't already.
Or you could check out the corresponding episode of this podcast where we interviewed some of the folks from my documentary. That's episode 19 from back in February of 2017.
God, we've been doing this a long time.
We have.
Anyway, when we interviewed Laverne earlier, we covered a lot of ground. We talked about what it was like growing up in Mobile, Alabama, her rise to fame, transgender roles in Hollywood. Laverne was especially excited about the then upcoming TV show Pose on FX, which explores New York City's ballroom community in the 1980s.
And that show, by the way, has since come out to rave reviews, so she had a reason to be excited. We also talked a lot about the Me Too movement because it was sort of in full bloom when we had our conversation.
And in the last several months, Laverne sure has been busy.
She sure has, Brian. She hosted the Lifetime beauty competition show, Glam Masters. She also released a dance club song called Beat for the Gods. Hey, she stole my song. And when we spoke earlier this year, Laverne and I began by talking about how the two of us first met a few years back. We have an interesting backstory, if you will. So just for our listeners, and I'm not embarrassed to talk about it because I think it's important to own the fact that I screwed up and what I learned from my mistakes mm-hmm. with your help. But a few years ago on my talk show, I was doing something with the right spirit of trying to help people understand transgender issues, which really wasn't being talked about very much at that moment in time. I think it was back in 2014.
Yes.
And
now 4 years ago.
I know. Isn't that crazy?
4 years ago this month, actually.
And really?
It aired 4 years ago this month.
Well, Carmen Carrera came on the show. Carmen Carrera is a trans model, and she was interested in being the first Victoria's Secret's trans model. And she came on, and in a very awkward and inappropriate moment, I asked her about her private parts.
The medication I mean, you still, your private parts are different now, aren't they?
I don't want to talk about it because it's really personal. And I don't know.
I didn't quite understand how offensive that was to someone. Of course, it would be offensive if someone asked me. And clearly, it was offensive to Carmen, you know, understandably so. Laverne saved the day and came out, and we had a conversation about it. But it really exploded in the trans community. People were really upset about it, angry with me, and it was mortifying. And I was so embarrassed. And later on in the season, Laverne came back, and we actually sat down and had a long conversation about why that was so inappropriate. And I remember the producers, Laverne, they did not want me to do that. They were like, no, don't talk about it. I said, no, I want to talk about it. Tell me your impressions when you saw Twitter exploding with all that venom toward me. I'm just curious what your reaction was.
Gosh. Katie, oh, that was an intense time, and you're taking me back. First of all, I want to say that publicists, producers often say don't talk about something, and that if you talk about an issue, that controversy, that it sort of perpetuates
right.
it. And so, but then when you don't talk about it, then we don't really get a chance to have the educational moment. We don't get to have the teachable moment, is the way you put it at the time. And so I was so excited that you were willing and open to talk about it. And I think about the moments I've had, because I think when you're a public figure, you're constantly putting yourself out there and you're going to, quote unquote, make mistakes or get things wrong and upset people. And that's deeply, deeply painful. And I felt that. I felt that even though we weren't talking, I felt like how painful it was for you to be going through that and to have the courage to be on television and to say, I made a mistake. And what can we do to rectify that? It's like so hard to do and it's so painful. But I think that, and I saw the speech I made in London at the Attitude Awards about that, for me, feels like this model of how we can go forward. It's going to be painful. It's going to hurt. But if we can be accountable and be teachable, then we can begin to model that for other people. So when it all happened, though, at the time, what was exciting for me is that my whole life I've been watching TV talk shows. I've done presentations about TV talk shows that have, since the 50s and 60s, having conversations about trans people and not necessarily reducing us to surgeries and transition and body parts, but what I said on the show is when we focus on that, that becomes the only takeaway because it sensationalizes our identities. And having watched those interviews over the years, I've never really seen anyone on television push back and say, maybe we should be having a different conversation.
Right.
So what was really exciting for me is that Carmen and I got the opportunity to talk back and to say, maybe we should be having a different conversation. And so I think when I saw Twitter exploding, what was exciting for me is that because of social media and because of that moment Carmen and I were able to have with you, because we pre-shot that, so you didn't actually have to air that.
Right. That's actually a little interesting factoid about the whole situation.
Yeah.
You know, my producer said, do you want to take that out? Because, you know, it made me look foolish and deservedly so. And I said, no, keep it in, because I think it's maybe a question that other people would have asked or at least thought about. And I want people to understand that being a trans person is much more than your anatomy.
Yeah.
You know, it has very little to do with it. And, of course, I've been so educated since Laverne because of my documentary.
But I also think the conversation has changed. Certainly there's still an educational thing that still needs to happen around trans folks. There's so many misunderstandings and misconceptions about us. But I feel like with journalists now, it's different.
I agree.
I feel it's really different. And so that moment feels really pivotal. And I'm so grateful to you for that moment. I'm grateful that you didn't edit it out. I'm grateful to the community who pushed back. And I'm sure it was really painful for you, the way in which some folks in my community pushed back. But sometimes that's a necessary part of moving
it is.
Forward.
I mean, it is interesting when it comes to a social movement, sort of you have to bottle up and release that anger. And I think it's part of the process.
Yeah.
But I so appreciated, you mentioned that speech that you gave at the Attitudes Inspiration Award last fall. We actually pulled a clip because it was so nice. And I was so grateful, Laverne. So let's listen for a second.
It is important that we begin to look for models of transformation and encourage that. And with the way we got there with Katie is that I was willing to have conversations with her with love and empathy. I do not believe that we can get to that transformation by publicly shaming people.
And so for people who didn't watch these shows and didn't follow this controversy as closely as some did, particularly in the trans community, what do you think are the key lessons that people who are not trans can take away from that back and forth?
For people who aren't trans, I mean, there's so many things. Part of it, I think, is the love and empathy piece that so often what I've learned, especially over the last year, is that not everyone is coming from a place of good intentions. I think with Katie, it was clear that you did have great good intentions, and it just got some things a little off. And so then when the intentions are clear, that we can begin to approach people with love and empathy and find ways to communicate our message better.
And I'm sure with that approach, I mean, can you feel when you change hearts and minds? Do people say to you, you know, thank you, I've been one of those people. Mm-hmm. Can you see their hearts opening up and their minds changing with this approach?
I have. And learning doesn't always happen in the moment. It's incremental, but I think, I mean, part of what I get to do as an artist, too, is that when you, as an actor, that's the work of being an actor. It's having empathy for a character, the characters that I play. I can never sort of approach a character with, like, I don't like this person. I always have to find a way, even if the character's done some reprehensible things, to empathize with her and find a way in. So that's the work of being an artist, is to have empathy and love for the characters I play and to hopefully convey that to audiences. And so that's the work that I do as an artist. And so I think that hopefully will translate into the work I do elsewhere. Being an artist is what informs everything that I do. And there's a legacy of revolutionary artists, progressive artists who, through their work and their activism, have proceeded that way. And so I have a wonderful legacy to look to for inspiration.
Well, we've seen a similar journey of understanding happen around the issue of marriage equality.
Mm-hmm.
Understanding around trans issues is probably a little bit behind where marriage equality is. But that was maybe the fastest social change in America than anybody can remember. Part of it had to do with the change in calling it marriage equality as opposed to gay marriage,
mm-hmm.
how you talk about it, how you kind of find the way in to people mm-hmm. who are maybe instinctually not as understanding or haven't come across these people as much as some others.
Yeah.
Do you think there are things that the trans community has done or still needs to do in order to make further progress?
There's a lot that we have to do. And there's fewer trans people than there are gay and lesbian people. The way you've alluded to changing the conversation from quote-unquote gay marriage to marriage equality, having the conversation differently is key. And that's a lot of the work that I'm trying to do is to shape the conversation in a different way. But, I mean, trans people are under attack right now in this country. There's just the list of, like, really legislative things that are happening, policy things that are happening around rescinding, you know, guidelines for trans kids, anti-trans bathroom bills introduced in state legislatures all over the country. Trans folks, there's a fight for us to be able to serve openly in the military right now. It goes on and on and on. There's 2017 was the deadliest year on record for trans people in terms of being murdered. Our lives are on the line. So a lot of it is about, it's an intersectional issue. So when we talk about trans stuff, and this, it gets complicated because it's not just a gender thing. It's a race thing. It's a class thing. It's an access to education. It's an access to housing and jobs. And so all of those things sort of are diminishing our life. It's sexual assault, all these things.
I was going to say, it's a crime thing.
Yeah.
And I want to talk about intersectionality. I want to talk about sort of being under assault in this Trump administration in the current policy in a second. But before we do that, Laverne, I want to talk about your story, your life story, because it's so fascinating and I'm sure was harrowing when you were younger. You were born in Mobile,
Alabama. Yeah.
You were raised by a single mom. You never met your dad.
I met my dad once.
You did?
Once.
When you were how old?
I think I was in third grade. I was in third grade. Yeah.
Do you remember that?
I do. I'm not going to talk about it.
Really?
I think there's some things, the whole circumstances leading up to that, that were really, really painful. And I've worked through all that with my mom. And so out of respect to my mother and my family, I can't talk about all those details.
I totally understand.
But yes, once I met my biological father.
You have an identical twin brother.
Yes.
And just one brother.
Just one sibling.
Yeah.
Correct.
And I'm just curious what it was like growing up. I think about you in Mobile, Alabama. Mm-hmm. I know you attempted suicide when you were 11 years old.
Mm-hmm.
paint a picture for us, Laverne, about what life was like.
I mean, I have a lovely therapist now. She reminds me often that it's both and. So, like, yes, I was bullied. I was chased home from school practically every day, and kids wanted to beat me up. I got beaten up a lot. I was a very fast runner. I didn't feel safe anywhere. But I was also a really creative kid. I started dancing when I walked, and I begged my mother to put me into dance classes. And finally, when I was in third grade, she found a free program where I could study dance. And that, I believe that dancing saved my life. I choreographed dance routines and, like, competed in talent shows all over the Southeast. And there's still trophies in my house back in Alabama, my mom's house.
I know you have said it saved your life.
Yeah. Being creative, and I was a good student. I read constantly. We were in walking distance from the Mobile Public Library, so I was at the library all the time reading. I was a total nerd.
Is your twin as smart as you are?
He's probably smarter. Yeah,
really?
He's smarter. My brother's brilliant. He's really, really smart.
And by the way, if you haven't watched Orange is the New Black, you can meet Laverne's brother on that show.
He's definitely playing a character, though. My brother is punk rock and goth. He defines himself as a practicing homosexual who is Negro goth, punk rock, and a free black man. He's a musician and an artist, and his work is very... Imlamar is his name, imlamar.com, if people care about his work. He really sort of hates... He hates that he did Orange is the New Black because people... It's so funny because if you Google most famous, well-known trans people, there's, like, before, people always want to see what trans people look like before. And people have a photo of my brother and then me side by side. I'm like, that's kind of hilarious. But they have a photo of him from Orange is the New Black, and he doesn't even look like that in real life. He wears, like, eyeliner, and he has long hair.
But that's the character he played on the show.
But that's the character he played, yeah. My character pre-transition.
But when did you start struggling with your gender identity? Do you remember from the very beginning?
It wasn't a struggle for me. It was a struggle for everybody else. I was always feminine. I was always, you know, I really thought that there was no difference between boys and girls because everyone was telling me I was a boy and I knew that I was a girl. So I just didn't think there were any differences. And then there was a therapy moment in third grade. I've talked about this a lot. My third grade teacher, Ms. Ridgway, called my mother on the phone and said, your son will end up in New Orleans wearing a dress if you don't get him to therapy right away. So I went to therapy, and there was this whole sort of, I guess we would call it reparative therapy around my gender expression at the time that was trying to fix me. And up until that time, I didn't think that there was really a difference between boys and girls. I knew that I was being bullied. I knew that people called me all kinds of anti-gay slurs. They called me a girl. And I think I've said the interesting irony of my life is that before I transitioned, kids called me a girl. And after I transitioned, people call me a man. and so, my gosh, it was just... It was intense, but I feel like it was everyone else's problem. And then it's something I internalized. I internalized a tremendous amount of transphobia, and I was like, I can't be this. And it wasn't until I moved to New York and met real trans people that I was able to accept trans people and then accept myself. But it was a problem for everybody else. Leontine Price, my idol, she's an opera singer, and when she talks about race, she said, it's not the black people's problem. It's everybody else's problem. And that's really how I see it with the gender stuff. And I think for me, I had to sort of find access to medical care and find ways to survive because it's hard. It's as smart as you think I might be. I was working in a restaurant, a drag queen restaurant before Orange is the New Black sort of became a sensation. And
this was in New York.
In New York City. And I have a college degree and I was writing, you know, articles for Huffington Post, and I'm kind of a smart chick, but a lot of people wouldn't have hired me. You know, I couldn't really get a job. There's a lot of people who wouldn't have hired me, as brilliant as I might seem. And there's a lot, there's a lot of trans people out there who are brilliant who can't get jobs because they're trans.
And you were inspired, at least in part, by a trans woman named Candace Kane.
Yeah.
For people in our audience who don't know who she is, can you describe her and tell us the impact she had in your life?
Candace Kane! I love Candace Kane. She's a New York City legend, and she's a trans woman, and a lot of people got to know her on Caitlyn Jenner's reality show, I Am Kate. But before that, in 2007, she became the first openly transgender actress to have a recurring role in a primetime TV show. And that show was Dirty Sexy Money. That was 11 years ago. And that moment made me believe that it was possible to be openly trans and have a career as an actor. I've been at this point, I had a degree in dance. I studied acting and dance in college. I had done a number of independent films and just been going to acting class every week, you know, and interning. I interned at Susan Batson's studio in New York City, and I mopped the floors and answered the phones so I can get acting classes for free. Thank you, Susan. So I had a little scholarship, and so being an actor is something I committed myself to, you know, just doing the grind in New York, doing off-Broadway theater or student films or whatever I could do just to work. And when I saw that moment from Candace, I was like, this is the moment. And that I sent out postcards.
I love this story, by the way. Was this sending out postcards from New York or from Mobile?
I was in New York at the time. So I was already in New York. I went to college in New York and sent out postcards to agents and casting directors, like 500. And I was like, Laverne Cox is the answer to all your transgender acting needs, because I knew there was sort of a niche for being trans and being an actor. Not a lot of great parts at the time, but there was something, mostly sex workers and crime victims. It's not funny, but it kind of is. And then the manager that I have now to this day, Paul Jalopo, is one of the four meetings I got from that those 500 postcards.
That's amazing. I mean, that's a real lesson, by the way, in ingenuity and persistence and just putting yourself out there, that you sent all these postcards out and you got four meetings from
it. Four meetings. I had a commercial agent for a minute. That didn't work out, but then I got a legit acting agent. Paul Jalopo is my agent for many years now. He's my manager. And he saw something in me. And there were many years I didn't work at all over the 11 years that we've been together. I'd be like, oh my God, why has he not dropped me? You know, if you're an agent, you have a client and they're not working. But he just saw something in me and he stuck with me and it's kind of worked out.
Well, it certainly has. I mean, you did a number of appearances on Law & Order, I know.
Yeah.
And then you did some reality shows, some independent films. You produced a documentary.
I produced a couple documentaries.
And one in particular about the lives of seven trans children, I believe.
Seven trans youth. The time they were between the ages of 12 and 24. I'm so proud of all of them right now. Zoe Luna just had her HBO show about her quinceañera. She was 12 when we interviewed her. Shane Hanis has been in a Kenneth Cole ad.
Wow.
And he got a full scholarship to Columbia at grad school after the T word. I'm just, anyway, all of them are really fantastic, and I'm so proud of all of them.
I know I'm kind of like totally fangirling on poor Laverne, but think about what you were able to do for these young people by helping them adjust, by giving them attention, and by kind of launching their careers.
I think I try not to be too arrogant about what I did. I think what we were able to do with Laverne Cox Presents the T-Word, and you can watch the documentary on YouTube or on Logo TV, is that we gave them a platform to tell their stories. And then with that, what were they able to do on top of that? What I learned, and I had this conversation with every one of them, that this is an opportunity for you to have a platform. Now it's time to hustle. And what I learned from having done reality TV when I did a show called I Want to Work for Diddy in 2008, and that was that's directly because of Candace Kane. That was literally the next year because I sort of put myself out there in a new way. I learned that reality television was a platform, but then now it was time for me to hustle and to really capitalize on that. And so that's what I've tried to do in a way that's respectful to myself and to the art and what I want to do. But that was what I said to the young people. So then it was on them.
But, I mean, let's be honest, giving them a platform change their worlds.
I hope so. Well, Shane has told me that it has, and a few of the young people have told me that it has been transformative for them. So that makes me happy.
Let's take a quick break. We'll be back with more of our fascinating conversation with this week's Wonder Woman, Laverne Cox.
The truth, Katie, is that most of us are brushing our teeth wrong. Not for long enough.
No.
Yes, not for long enough, and we forget to change our brush on time. That's because most brands focus on selling flashy gimmicks rather than better brushing, but not Quip.
Quip is an electric toothbrush that costs a fraction of bulkier brushes and packs the right amount of vibrations to clean your teeth. The built-in timer and guiding pulses, this is kind of turning me on, help you clean for the full dentist-recommended 2 minutes. Quip's subscription is built for your health, delivering new brush heads every 3 months for just $5, including free shipping worldwide.
Quip also comes with a suction mount that unsticks to use as a cover for hygienic travel.
Now, everyone loves Quip. Jinx, They were on Oprah's O-List, named one of Time's best inventions, and is the first subscription electric toothbrush accepted by the ADA, the American Dental Association.
Quip starts at just $25, and if you go to getquip.com/Katie right now, you'll get your first refill pack free with a Quip electric toothbrush. That's your first refill pack free at getquip.com/Katie, spelled GETQUIP.com/KATIE.
Thanks, as usual, to those of you who have left your reviews over at Apple Podcasts.
Like Loretti. Is this your friend, Loretti, Katie?
It might
Maybe.
Be.
Who says, objectively, I love Katie Couric's podcasts. They make you feel good and you always learn things. Wish she did them every day. Well, Loretti, it's very similar to a review my mother gave me personally.
Every day. Thanks for the props, Loretti. But I think we're going to have to stick to once a week for now.
Leave us a review on Apple Podcasts and we may just read it on the air. And now back to our conversation with Laverne Cox. Your big break when most people in this country first clapped eyes on Laverne Cox was when you got the role on Orange is the New Black.
Yeah.
How did that come about and how has that changed your life?
It's funny because right before I booked Orange, I was thinking maybe I was done acting. Maybe I had been a number of independent films, I had done some TV, and I was thinking maybe I was done. I hadn't booked anything for going on a year.
You were still working at the restaurant.
I was still working at Lucky Chang's, the restaurant, every week. And then I got the audition, and I did two scenes, one from the pilot episode of Orange and one from the episode 3, the famous duct tape flip-flops scene from season 1.
Oh, in fact, I'm glad you mentioned that. Because we have a clip from that.
Oh.
And since you did the perfect segue.
I auditioned with this scene.
All right, well, let's listen to you. We'll just remind people.
I made my own couture. Commissaire Duncari is size 13.
Is that duct tape?
Metallics are very in this season.
I remember that scene so well, Laverne. When you heard about this role, were you just thinking, oh, God, this is going to be so fantastic. Were you trepidatious?
I was at an event with my manager, Paul, and he said, I have an audition for you. It's set in a women's prison. You're a hairdresser in a women's prison. I was like, women's prison? I was like, it sounded really intriguing. He said it was a web series, and this is 2012, so there were no streaming television shows. There were web series. So I was just like, okay, a web series, cool. And then I got the pilot script, and it was brilliant. And Jinji Cohen, I was a huge fan of Weeds, like huge.
And I love her, by the way.
I love her, too.
She's the creator and the executive producer of that show.
Exactly. And then I did the audition, got the part. I was screaming. I was on the street, and I started screaming. And I was hopeful that people might watch it, but I was just so excited to be working. I dedicated my life to being an actor, and it's a really hard thing to do, to be an artist. And so I was just happy to have a job. And then it turned into this thing where, like, episode 3 was my character's backstory, and Jodie Foster was directing, and that was a dream come true. And
did you have a moment when you thought, wow, this is really clicking? This is something special.
Season 1, it was just what I love about season 1 of our show is that it was so about the work. And I was just so excited to do the work, that I had been training for all these years. And then there was a moment, I think episode, it was the rap battle scene, episode 6 or so of season 1. And I looked around and it was a room full of women of all ages and backgrounds and sexual orientations, and I'm in the middle there, and I just was like, this is the coolest thing I've ever seen in my life. I don't know if anybody's going to watch it or care, but this is awesome. And I didn't honestly think anybody would watch it. I knew it was good and special, but I just had never seen anything like it. And so I was like, where does this fit in the marketplace, you know? And then it's on Netflix. I was just, my dream really was, I was like, I hope casting directors watch it and see that I can act and maybe I'll get another job. You know, that for real.
If this doesn't work out.
That was for real.
When people didn't think of Netflix as the behemoth that it's become.
No.
I mean, spending $7 billion a year on content and all the rest. But let me ask you, since you first appeared and broke through on that show, how do you think opportunities for trans actors have changed?
Gosh, it's a mixed bag when I talk to my trans friends who are actors. There are more roles than there used to be, and the roles are different. I'm so excited about Ryan Murphy's new show, Pose, that's coming out over the summer. There's 6 transgender series regulars on that show, all trans women of color, and they're so talented.
And what is it about?
It's about the ballroom community in New York City in the 1980s. Like that movie Paris is Burning, if you right. saw that. So it's about these balls that are sort of competitions where people vogue and people sort of have different categories like realness and face, et cetera. So it's the sort of drag, trans, LGBTQ balls of color that Madonna's Vogue comes out of that community. And it's really when... our current president was building all these huge buildings, and so New York was changing a lot in the late 80s as well. So that's the backdrop of Pose, which is so excited about it.
So that's exciting for people in the trans community, but how has it been a mixed bag?
There's still a lot of casting directors aren't calling us in for roles that are not trans.
Well, that's the thing, right? Is the real victory going to be when you don't have to play a trans person, but you get to play a woman, period?
Yeah, I just get to play a character, and the gender identity doesn't matter. I think that is the victory, more opportunities. And I think, but there's so many trans stories that need to be told as well. And so more trans folks directing and writing and working behind the scenes is actually really crucial too. To Pose's credit, there's two trans writers and there's some trans people directing and working on the crew. A show I did on CBS called Doubt, we had a trans writer. And I have a show in development at ABC now called Spirited that is not a trans character. And that's I'm the lead of. So,
oh, wow. Great.
Hopefully that pilot will be in the pipeline.
But you feel like you need to have both stories of trans people, but also trans people being cast without regard to their gender
Absolutely.
Identity.
Absolutely, because if you're right for the part, it shouldn't matter. I've always said if it doesn't involve menstrual cycles or pregnancy, I should be able to play it. And then the question is, does the character become trans when I play the character? I'm as a black actress. Whenever I play a character, the character becomes black. And does the character become trans when I play her, even if it's not written that way? So that's an interesting question that we'll see.
Well, and to that point, you have cisgendered men, that is, people who were born as men, playing... Assigned male at birth.
And identify as male.
Thank you for that. being cast as trans women.
Yes.
I.e. Jeffrey Tambor on Transparent, although, you know, he may...
I.e. Jared Leto, i.e. Eddie Redmayne, who are, you know... I was about to say all lovely people, but...
how do you feel about that, though, you know?
There is certainly a push now in the trans community and beyond to cast trans people to play trans characters. Trans people need jobs. I said earlier that our unemployment rate is about 4 times the national average. And Jen Richards, a brilliant writer, actress, she argues that specifically when cisgender men, non-transgender men are cast to play transgender women, that leads to violence against us because it sends the message that she contends that trans women are really men. So Jared Leto beautifully plays this trans character in Dallas Buyers Club and then arrives at the Oscars and Golden Globes with a beard. And so men who find themselves attracted to trans women then see this guy with a beard and it sends this message that trans women are really not women at all, but men. And so she contends that leads to violence against us. So I think the other piece of that is that men who are attracted to trans women need to deal with their internalized homophobia and transphobia. What's been so exciting for me as a trans actress playing a trans character on Orange is the New Black is that people have, audience members have not just empathized with the character that I play, but they find themselves empathizing with the actress who plays her. And so there's been so much, I think it's inarguable that there's been so much change because of that part that I got to play and people connecting with this character and then connecting with the actress on a human level.
Well, think how many people have been educated by Sophia, right?
Yeah.
I mean, it broke through this whole notion of gender identity and it just got right to the heart of the person,
yeah.
Which I think is the most persuasive tool possible, right?
You have to be able to see people as human beings. And I think, according to a study from GLAAD, 86% of folks in the United States do not know someone trans. And so what we do in the media is how folks get to know trans folks.
Exactly.
So it's crucial. It's life-saving or life-threatening if the representation in the media does not accurately and multidimensionally depict who trans people really are.
One of the people I featured in my documentary was Gavin Graham. You can't see right now, but Laverne just kind of made a little prayer sign and held it up to her face because Gavin is an extraordinary person. Mm-hmm. How did you first get to know Gavin?
I became aware of his case it would have been 2016.
We should say, by way of background, Gavin came out as transgender in high school.
In Virginia, yeah.
His county school board said that he couldn't use the boys' restroom. So apologies for the interruption. But
no, that's fine. Well, initially he was allowed. And then parents found out and said, we can't do this. And everything was fine. Gavin was going to the boys' room. No, the kids didn't have any issue. There was no issue. And then the school board finds out and says, no, this can't happen.
And they had a big hearing, by the way. And just before we talk a little more about Gavin, we have a clip from what I thought was one of the most moving moments of my documentary is when, by the way, we didn't film it. It was when Gavin spoke before the school board, and there was a whole group of people. And he was,
I believe, just
15 years old.
Yeah.
And he was so composed and so extraordinary. Let's listen to what he said.
Yes.
I've been aware of who I was since I was a very young kid, and it's taken me a very long time to be able to be myself and be okay with that. The person I am now, being able to have all of my rights in full, is such a massive dynamic difference from the person I was just last summer. I would like to say, too, that if the evidence said that me using the boys' room would be catastrophic, I would not be advocating for myself. Regardless of my personal emotions over this issue, I look only at the facts, as one should in an issue that requires separation of church and state and feelings and state.
That clip makes me cry every time I hear it, Laverne. And so you heard about Gavin's situation. Did you reach out to him?
I did, actually. My friend Chase Strangio, who works at the ACLU, is a lawyer at the ACLU, is handling Gavin's case. And it was a major, it was going to be a major decision. Or it was the it would have been the first time the Supreme Court would have heard an issue about transgender rights. And so I sent him a video message, and then we arranged to meet Gavin. It was like a week after the Grammys, a year ago, I remember. And I was moved by everything I had read about him and the videos I'd seen about him. And then when I met him, he's so smart and so calm and composed. It's amazing. I freak out. I mean, when all this attention is on me and I get such anxiety, and he seems so calm. And his mom is amazing. I think it's over 50% of trans kids, when they have family support, their lives are completely different in terms of positive outcomes for them being who they are.
Because we should just mention how high the suicide rate is among trans children and trans youth.
Yeah. It's over 41% of trans people have attempted suicide. And
I think
it's 50% of trans youth have attempted suicide. And so it's, I think sometimes people want to sort of suggest that we're mentally ill, but if you live in a culture that tells you constantly and sends messages to you constantly that you are mentally ill, that you are a deviant, that you shouldn't exist, and that every message you're receiving constantly from everyone around you and from the media is that you shouldn't exist and that you are a pariah, it is really hard to love yourself. It is really hard to think that you have a right to exist. And that's what I want. That's what I want trans kids to know, that you have a right to exist and that you're anointed, that you are beautiful and that you're here for a reason and that you have to find a way to survive so you can fulfill that reason for being here.
The Supreme Court decided not to hear Gavin's case.
Well, they decided not to hear Gavin's case because the current administration, the Justice Department, rescinded the Obama-era guidelines.
Right.
Around how transgender kids should be treated in school. And so when the Justice Department rescinded those guidelines, then
there
was no case, basically.
What did those guidelines say?
Basically, a lot of people thought they were about bathrooms, right? So they did say that, you know, trans kids should be able to use a bathroom that is consistent with their gender identity. But it also talked about preferred name. It talked about how other kids should treat them in school. So it was a whole host of guidelines. So it was
and
really
protections,
about
really.
Making sure that trans kids were safe in schools and that they were treated in a way that was respectful for them so they could learn. Education is the reason I'm sitting here, and people should have safe schools.
And that was just the first, I think, thing that the Trump administration did that has started to erode the progress that had heretofore been made before he was elected.
Yeah, not just for trans people, but for across the board. The Justice Department, even though people have to remember that the current administration has not been very successful legislatively, but in terms of the Justice Department, they've been very successful rolling back mandatory minimums, so many progressive things that the Obama administration did. So we got to continue to resist.
When, in fact, back in July, President Trump tweeted that transgender individuals will not be allowed to serve in the U.S. military.
Mm-hmm.
Has that been implemented?
So
remember, that was so crazy because ostensibly President Trump had cleared this with his military leaders, but then they said he'd never talked to them
about
it. Yeah,
ostensibly meaning he didn't.
Right. And then suddenly, and then that changed, right?
After the tweet, the I guess Department of Defense got some policy together to basically try to ban on trans people. And now, mind you, trans people have just been able to serve openly, barely. And it was something that, like, Obama—
It started in 2015,
yeah,
I believe.
But luckily, at this point, two judges have said that this is unconstitutional and there's no reason to ban trans people. I think it's probably going to end up at the Supreme Court.
So and in the meantime, what's happening to transgender people who are currently serving in the military?
From my understanding, they should be treated with kindness and respect. But again, it sends a message when the leader of the free world, I feel like I use that term loosely now.
Let the record show there's some air quotes happening.
says that you shouldn't have a right to serve your country.
And what other things have happened in the last year, Laverne, that have really kind of put trans people in the crosshairs?
I think over 20 states have passed about 50 pieces of legislation that basically criminalize trans people using the bathroom that is consistent with their gender identity. 50 pieces of legislation. A number of those pieces of legislation have been struck down, notably in Texas. But a lot of people think that HB 2 in North Carolina, a lot of people thought that that was repealed. It actually wasn't. They basically made a new bill that basically institutes the same kind of discrimination against trans people because they wanted to basically get their corporate folks back. And so a lot of people think that that's settled in North Carolina. It actually isn't. The ACLU and other organizations are still, I think it's Lambda Legal, are still suing the state of North Carolina because they're trying to criminalize trans people going to the bathroom
still. Well, in fact, this has had a profound impact on politics. The governor of North Carolina who signed the infamous bathroom ban legislation.
He's not with us anymore.
Yeah, he lost his race.
Well, he's lost his race. I think he's still alive.
I think he's still around, but he's no longer governor.
Exactly.
Largely as a result of the backlash on this issue. Mm-hmm. And last year, we saw Danica Rome, I think that's how you pronounce her name,
yes,
in Virginia be the first openly trans person elected and seated in a U.S. state house.
Yay, Virginia.
In the Senate.
Andrea Jenkins was the first openly transgender black woman to be elected to public office in the U.S. She was elected to the Minneapolis City Council. Yes.
And I've met Andrea. We did a panel when I was in Minnesota like a couple years ago.
And now Chelsea Manning has filed to run for Senate in the state of Maryland.
Been more of a controversial character.
Yes.
Having nothing to do with her status.
But still, I mean, I think it says a lot that we've seen this happen. And that must be a positive in a year that's been full of a lot of negatives.
Well, I think what has happened because of the current administration is that a lot of folks of various backgrounds are choosing to run for office and are winning. And that, I think if there's anything positive that has come out of this current administration is that folks have woken up.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of folks got complacent under my beloved President Obama. I love him and we miss you. we miss you, Obamas. I think a lot of folks got very complacent and didn't realize that a lot of basic civil liberties were at stake. And I think that is very clear now.
The last time I checked, and I'm sure the number's higher, 11,000 women were running for office.
Mm.
And I think that brings us to sort of the Me Too movement. And I'm curious what you think of this movement, Laverne, if you believe it is intersectional enough that it—
What does intersectional mean, Kate?
So it's really talking about race. It's talking about gender. It's talking about gender identity, not just white women in Hollywood and or beyond even. And that if you think it's expansive enough. So what are your thoughts?
I think we can always be more intersectional. We can always include more people.
I should say women of color, really.
Yeah, I mean, intersectionality really— For people of, I don't just experience the world as a trans woman. I experience the world as a black person, and I have multiple identities. And having a social movement, it's funny, as I've been doing a lot of rereading of bell hooks and a lot of black feminists from, you know, the 70s and 80s, and really for over 30 years, there have been women of color, queer women have been critiquing a lot of second wave feminism that, you know, 30 years ago, black feminists were like, we need to expand this idea of woman womanhood, and we cannot use biological essentialism to have conversations about women, that we have to be inclusive. So that conversation's been happening for a really long time.
I told you she was smart.
I never doubted it. I mean, I don't think anyone can hear her and doubt how well-informed, well-read you are on these issues. I mean, it's unbelievable.
But anyway, to
But so that conversation's been happening for a really long time. And, I mean, I think what we have to look at, I mean, with Weinstein, for example, I remember all these actresses came out and said, you know, that he had, you know, assaulted them and done the things that he's accused of doing. First person he challenged was Lupita Nyong'o, a Black woman. When he, all these other women, he didn't say anything. He didn't say that I didn't do it. But the first person he challenged was Lupita Nyong'o. And I think this can't be a coincidence. Her Blackness can't be a coincidence. I noticed when some trans women have come forward and said that they have been sexually assaulted, there's been a different tenor in terms of the ways in which they've been believed as opposed to other women who are not trans. It's all very, very tricky because there's a lot of trauma. I think when we're talking about sexual assault and sexual harassment, I think it's really, really important to talk about the healing that has to happen if you've been a victim or survivor. It's one of, I think, the worst things that can happen to someone, if not the worst. And so all of the healing that has to happen and what's exciting is that I've been rereading, you know, some of my Bell Hooks, and talking back, she says one of the most useful tools that women have, and it's not just women who've been victims of sexual assault and harassment, is our voice to be able to speak up and to speak out. And so it's amazing that I think we were just, the country was just ready for that, but I think we still need to, and it's not just because it's not just about including trans women, including women of color, including folks with disabilities or folks who are incarcerated, including all these folks. But it's like, what does it mean to have these folks in leadership positions and in decision-making roles? I'm finding myself, I'm very blessed to be in the position I'm in, but I'm trying to be critical of it. And I'm trying to really think about all the folks out there who don't have the platform I have, and what do they need, and what would they want me to say when I'm in these positions. And so much of it is about having not just the tokenized right. Hollywood trans woman Laverne Cox in positions and with seats at the table, but having diverse and other folks who don't have the same privileges I have.
Well, it seems to me that, you know, we have to start moving from outrage to policy changes and putting systems in place, and also, obviously, attitudes. Sometimes I think laws precede attitudes. If you look at the civil rights movement, right? I mean, it wasn't a popular thing to enact certain pieces of legislation, but it was the right thing, and then attitudes followed. And
somewhat. I mean, I think that's a really good example, though. We had the Civil Rights Act and the Voting Rights Act that were passed, and then Black folks, that did not end racism in America, ironically. Right. You know, Black folks are incarcerated at crazy rates
and
profiled by police, et cetera.
That's for sure, but I think if leaders wait for public sentiment to be on their side, that sometimes they'd be waiting for a very long time to at least take the first step of enacting legislation that is hopefully, eventually, one day, fingers crossed, going to change hearts and minds. But where should we go from here? I think it's been so extraordinary to see people being able to express themselves, use their voices, exhibit their outrage. But at some point, do we need to then take it to the next step?
And in Hollywood, by the way, there is this initiative called Time's Up that may be a part of moving forward on these issues.
But what are they going to do other than raise money for a legal defense fund for, you know, I mean, and not just Hollywood, but how can policies and change, and how can we put systems in place so that it is better for that woman who's working on an assembly line at a factory in Iowa?
That's part of it. Rosa Clemente, who's been doing a lot of work around Puerto Rico, we have to remember that Puerto Ricans, the island is still mostly without power and without clean drinking water. She reminded me when we met that protests are important, but then we have to do the organizing after the protests. And so the organizing is about policy and hopefully systemic shifts. So I was at a Time's Up meeting this past week, and so the Legal Defense Fund is one of the things that Time's Up is doing. There's other work too that's on the horizon that you will find out more about later, that it's about those policy shifts. And I think really it's, how do we make workplaces safe for everyone. Anti-sexual harassment policies have existed in, I think, 90% of organizations for a very long time. But so much of that is about not getting sued, but it doesn't change the culture in those organizations. So we have to be able to change the culture and then who's in power. A lot of folks think that it's about having diverse leadership so that we have more women in leadership positions and more people of color and just more diversity. And so and hopefully that can begin to change the culture so that it's not okay to interrupt women at meetings. And so it's not okay
to make... They call that heap-eating.
What is
it? Oh, no, that's mansplaining. Well, I'm doing this whole thing for National Geographic, and one of my hours is on gender inequality in Hollywood and Silicon Valley and beyond. Mm-hmm. And there's something called heap-eating, and that means if you're at a meeting and a woman has a suggestion and everybody's like, yeah, 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 kind of blows her off, then the man says it. And
everyone's like,
that's a great idea.
You see, there's this thing called heap-eating. There's this thing called heap-eating that men do where a woman makes a point and everyone ignores her, and then the guy repeats the same thing and people
listen.
For the illustration, Brian. But anyway, but I do think
but that those kinds of cultural shifts, these things are important. I think sometimes people think that liberals get sort of, you know, want to police language and want to say you can and can't say this. It's not about that. It's about how do we begin to change the culture, because those cultures influence policies and influence the ways in which people are treated and if they feel safe or not in a workplace or on the street. Or
there may be sexual harassment policies, but I don't think they've been taken seriously. I think that when they have, like, diversity training or sexual harassment awareness, that most people just roll their eyes. And now I think those times have changed. But do you think that more men should be invited into the conversation? Because I think right now, at this juncture, I think there are a lot of men who are so fearful. Mm-hmm. And I think that some of them believe, like, we need to spend this time listening. But at some point, we need men to join forces with women and not just listen. So do you feel like they've been shut out of the conversation too much?
I think we have to be really careful not to foreground men's voices. I think we're talking about white cisgender men's voices in a movement that needs to be about women coming to voice and women having a space, so that we can't foreground those voices. But men, we can't really topple the patriarchy without men being engaged in that. I think my friend Matt McGorry does so much work around Black Lives Matter and around having conversations with white people around their own racism. And so I think men need to be having conversations with each other. And I know some incredible guys who are doing that work. Listening to women of all different backgrounds, trans, you know, women with disabilities, listening and then having conversations with other men and saying, this is no longer acceptable to talk about women this way and to have conversations. And then what can we do to change policies, to change hearts and minds? And then how can we interrogate ourselves? I think a lot of men, too, what I've come to realize, this movement has been really intense for me. I got to, I can't believe I'm going to talk about this because I'm not maybe ready to fully talk about it, but I got to confront a man that I'd had a sexual encounter with, that the encounter was consensual, but then something happened that wasn't consensual. And I was able to recently confront him about that. And what was interesting for me in the confrontation is that he had no idea that his behavior was predatory, that he didn't have consent. And I think so often the idea of consent is something that men aren't really clear about. And I'm very clear that what happened was not consensual and it was not okay, and I was able to assert that to him. But that's a different kind of conversation. What does consent look like? A woman I know named who teaches sex ed in New York, and she teaches kids. She's having conversations, you know, in middle school, really early on, about what consent is and looks like. And we have to be really careful about the messages we're sending to our young people of all genders about what consent is. And so those kinds of conversations men should be having with themselves, with each other, and then ultimately with women, and then listening more. And then we all have to be engaged in changing the culture.
Is it just too early to kind of push that, as you say, foreground their voices?
No, we should not be foregrounding their voices. I love men.
And by the way, what is foregrounding mean exactly?
Foregrounding so that we Because the problem is that far too often we've listened to men and not listened to women. We're at a point now when women are finally being believed and something
and heard,
and we have to continue that. That doesn't mean I love men. That doesn't mean we hate men. That doesn't mean that we want to sort of demonize men. But we have to foreground the voices and experiences of women. And then I think too, whether it's not just women who are experiencing sexual assault either. Anthony Rapp, we have to remember, came forward with some really important information about a well-known actor that we all know. And Terry Crews and other men have come forward and said that they too have been. And I know a lot of men personally who've experienced sexual assault. So it's a conversation that we all need to have. But then there's something about power and accountability. I think for so long it was just okay to do this stuff. And time's up.
I feel like we should also just talk briefly about pay inequality.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a big story, this will air a couple of weeks after this whole incident, but that got a lot of attention is Michelle Williams versus Mark Wahlberg. And I found that really upsetting, but also so interesting on multiple levels, because I think, per usual, Michelle Williams was trying to be super accommodating and saying, I'll do whatever it takes, I'll, you know, skip my holiday, I'll go to Italy over Thanksgiving,
yeah,
or whatever.
Yeah.
And then she had the same representation as Mark Wahlberg, who got paid $1.5 million. Now, Brian told me earlier that there was some stipulation in his contract that he had approval over the replacement actor, blah, blah, blah. But the fact of the matter is, I mean—
Well, the man held it up so that he could get a bunch of money, and the woman said, oh, yeah, sure, I'm happy to be accommodating and, you know, do this whenever you want and get paid $1,000.
Which I think speaks to—
Less than $1,000, $80 a day per diem.
Which speaks to, I think, women and our discomfort in speaking up and demanding things and trying to be liked and being the good person. Versus Mark Wahlberg, who, of course, eventually gave the money to the Time's Up movement and to the Legal Defense Fund there. But, I mean, why does this keep happening? And how do you usher in a major paradigm shift for that?
There's so many issues there, and when I hear that, I know I can relate too, especially being still feeling new to the entertainment industry and feel like I'm just so lucky to be here. That
and you
I'm
don't
like,
want to do anything to piss people off.
And I don't want to do anything to piss anybody off, so I'm like, what do you need? And always trying to arrive and be easy to work with and agreeable and never difficult. And so that's something I really deeply relate to. Gosh, I think there's so many issues. There's so much that we probably don't even know about in terms of the contract negotiations. I'm excited that the money's going to Time's Up. I'm excited that that's happening. Michelle Williams is a brilliant, brilliant artist. Her body of work is so compelling. Her statement around this has been absolutely just magnanimous and inspiring. I love her. I don't know her personally, but I love the way that she's gone about all this.
But part of this is, I think, women starting to become accustomed to owning some power.
Yeah.
You know, and not being so worried and being able to demand things and not be afraid what that says about
them, right?
When it
comes to, I think it was Susie Orman who said that we need to talk about money more in general so that we are having conversations. How much are you making, you know? So that we should be openly having conversations about
more transparency.
What are other people getting? And then, so what should I be asking for? So that's part of it. But there's something I really get that desire to be like, what do you need? You know, they were reshooting the film because of the actor who they needed to
Kevin Spacey.
I say Kevin Spacey. It's pretty widely known.
I know, but I don't know for a reason. But like, so I get where Michelle was coming from. Let me do whatever I can. I get it.
Oh, no, it's laudatory in a way. On the other hand, it's like, why should we be pleasers? And why should we be so helpful?
Or maybe the men should be more helpful.
Yeah, I was going to say, is that a good thing, a bad thing? It's so confusing.
Oprah talks about how her life changed when she let go of her disease to please. And I'm still learning that, but really choosing. Then Brene Brown says her boundary mantra is choose discomfort over resentment. So that we're setting boundaries and not being in a space of like constantly wanting to please, but so that we can assert ourselves and feel and understand our value. I don't know Michelle personally. I don't know her, but I think she knows her value with, I think, 4 Oscar nominations in this body of work. But
she's just not a jerk.
Anyway, in closing.
Right?
Oh, Katie.
No, but you know what I mean? She's like, I mean, she's a mensch.
Yeah, she's a mensch. She's a mensch. Anywho, are there other projects you're working on that you can talk about?
Oh, Freak Show, right?
Freak Show's out now. Freak Show is in theaters and on demand. It's a beautiful movie set in a high school about a young kid named Billy Bloom who is kind of gender non-binary, likes to dress in fantastic costumes at school and gets bullied and ends up running for homecoming queen. and it's a really beautiful story. I have a teeny tiny part in it. Trudy Styler directs, and Bette Midler has a wonderful role in it. So folks can, I think in LA and New York, see Freak Show now or on demand. It's, you can just get it anywhere. It's fantastic. I love that movie.
And you're a model for Beyonce.
Yeah. I model, oh my God! I still can't believe it.
That's crazy.
Yeah, Beyonce chose me to be one of the faces of her autumn winter campaign for Ivy Park. The posters are still in top shops all over the world. I still get...
it's an activewear line.
It's an activewear line. It's her athleisure line. It's amazing. I was an Ivy Park fan even before I was modeling for it. Thank you, Beyonce.
That's you. Are you and Beyonce like this? I just did the thing where your fingers are together like you're super tight.
No, I've met Beyonce once. She was about to give birth when we shot the ad campaign. So I've only met her once. We're not tight like that. You know,
you've got to be a lot more Hollywood. You got to say, oh, we're very, very close. We've met.
I go kidding. Through that whole thing of like, should I be more Hollywood? I'm just going to be Laverne.
No,
I'm going to be in the truth.
Like, I think your honesty is actually very refreshing.
But she's so, I mean, I've interviewed her a couple of times. I haven't seen her for years, but in the early days of Destiny's Child and then when she started on her solo career, I had the pleasure of interviewing her, and I just adore her. I think she is so great and so talented. It's ridiculous.
Queen B, she is still the queen of us all. I have a few queens, and Beyonce is one. So I remain a ginormous fan.
Who's your other queen?
Oh my God, I have many queens: Oprah, Leontine Price, Viola Davis, a few.
When you look ahead at this year, you know what are your hopes and dreams? It was funny you were saying you wanted that role, and a continuing role that one year, and then Orange is the New Black popped up. What are your goals?
I want to get better at being an artist and being an actress. I got to work on, I'm going to be in the next season of Orange, and they wrote some really beautiful material for me, and I want to get better at what I do. I think being an actor is very difficult, and doing it well is difficult, but it's also a lifelong pursuit and something that you can get older and get better at. So I want to continue to expand. I have a new show called Glam Masters that's coming out on Lifetime. It's a competition reality show for makeup artists. Kim Kardashian West is one of the executive producers. I'm a co-executive producer as well, and I'm also a host and judge. And we're looking for the next big breakout star in the beauty industry. It's on Lifetime. It's premiering February 28th. I'm so proud of it. I've seen a lot of the episodes, and the contestants are incredible. You really understand that makeup isn't just, I'm not wearing makeup today, thank God. I love having my makeup-free days. But that makeup is not just about looking pretty, that it's an art. And these the makeup artists we have on the show really show you that, and the challenges that we give them illustrate that. And it's fun. We had so much fun.
So you're not only doing all your acting stuff, you're like turning into a mogul, Laverne.
I'm trying to continue to do what I love and I love a lot of different things. And so I'm trying to sort of go with the passion and be in a space of joy and multidimensionality. I'm not just one thing. And so I'm getting to explore all of these different sides of myself and showing the world that they can do that as well.
I think that's great. Well, I just, I adore you, Laverne.
I adore
and
you,
I'm so,
Katie Kirk.
So happy that you came by on a Sunday, no less,
so
to
nice
visit
of
with
really
us.
Nice
really
nice to meet you.
Good
thanks
to meet
for
you
doing
too.
This.
This has been so much fun. I can't wait to see how you edit this because we talked a lot.
We did talk a lot. A big thank you this week to the Invisible Studios in LA for today's recording, and our usual thanks to the lovely and talented Gianna Palmer for producing the show. We love Gianna, and we love Jared O'Connell for mixing it. Oh gosh, I don't want to leave anyone out. We love Nora Ritchie, our assistant producer, and Allison Bresnick on social media, Emily Bina over at Katie Couric Media. We love you too. And Beth, my assistant, I can't forget her. We love her a lot because she puts up with me every day. Beth's a Wonder Woman in her own right. Mark Phillips wrote our theme music. I would say I love you, Mark, but I don't even know you. And Brian and I are the show's executive producers. Talk to you next week, and thanks so much for listening, everyone.
Stitcher.
Now, in certain podcasts moving forward, Laverne, Brian and I have decided we're going to pick out a song that we think best exemplifies the spirit of our guests.
Oh.
So hit it, guys. Come on, Brian. This is when you're going to drop it like it's hot.
Yeah. I don't think anyone wants to hear that.
Lukewarm. Drop it like it's lukewarm.
Yeah.
We feel like hot stuff is appropriate for you, Laverne, because you are on fire.
That was an English royal we, by the way.
Yes. Oh, my God.
Hello, Deadbeats. It's Gabby. Gabby Dunn, host of Bad With Money. I had the Bad With Money book come out in January. I'm super stoked for season 4. This season, we're going back to our roots, and I'm having long conversations with amazing people and getting the big picture about money and the economy. Do you like intersectional, queer, social justice-based money podcasts? This is the only one, so get into it.
Did you earn it? Do you deserve to be like a billionaire when somebody who's working as a janitor or working in Walmart or a teacher who may be working just as many hours as you, maybe just as smart as you, like, does that make it okay that you have so much?
I get paid once a month, so my checking account's huge. It's like a tidal wave comes in, and then on the second, it's empty again.
Oh my God, just speaking my language. Bad With Money is back now for season 4. Listen in Stitcher, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.